Welcome to the Whiskey Rebellion. This is David Silconet in Edinburgh, and I'm joined as always by Frank Cogliano. How are you doing, Frank?
Hi, David. I'm doing great. I'm doing great. First week of teaching under our belt, so it's always an exciting
first week of teaching. I think before we dive into this week's topic, you said you wanted to make an addendum, a modification, a coda to our episode last week.
I do. I want to respond to some listener feedback. We love to hear from our listeners. I had a conversation with probably our most loyal listener, Simon in London, earlier in the week.
Mimi in Edinburgh?
Well, Mimi in Edinburgh. Mimi and Simon compete with each other as our most loyal listeners. I think Simon listens out of interest. Mimi is my wife, and she listens to make sure I haven't been too mean to you each week. So she's more, looking out for your interest in this. But anyway.
Thank you, Mimi, for doing that. I appreciate it.
But Simon in London and I chatted with Simon earlier in the week, and Simon responded to our episode last week about vaping.
Yes.
And tobacco and so on. And Simon gently corrected me on some of my assertions about the lack of coolness in vaping, which supports your view, David.
Yes. So you're down with the kids.
Yes, with both Simon and Mimi are defending you, David. Simon reports that he spoke to one of his children about this to get an estimate of how many of their friends were vaping, and let's just say the estimate was very, very high.
Ah, okay.
So vaping is much cooler than I think it is.
Yes.
And so I want to apologize to you, David, and to all of our listeners, but especially Simon, thank Simon for listening and for his feedback.
On the other hand, given how bad appears vaping may be for you, and there's been obviously even more news coverage in the past week since we recorded that episode, if you're listening, don't vape. It's probably not good for you. You know, chew bubble gum instead or something.
Right. Okay.
Yes. Pick up some other, habit.
Yeah, we're incredibly popular with school age kids. I'm sure this podcast is
exactly.
So.
speaking of school age kids, actually connects with our topic today, because around the world, there are climate strikes marches taking place. There's one here in Edinburgh that I just came from, where it appeared as if the entire city showed up for this climate strike.
I went out and caught the tail end of it.
It was a lot. I mean, like, it basically filled up, for those people familiar with the city, it filled up most of the meadows, people congregating at start, and it took more than an hour to sort of actually get them all going, head towards the Scottish Parliament.
I think there were protests today, or are protests ongoing, in nearly 3,000 cities in 162 countries on 7 continents.
Wow. Okay. So, I mean, this is a worldwide global phenomenon that has grown out of a student movement of school strikes that's happened here in Edinburgh and around the world. But we thought we'd use this as an opportunity to think about environmental awareness, environmental movements, environmental destruction in the American context in particular, and how this event today, which is, as we are recording this, is the events are starting in the U.S., put those into some context.
Yes.
Right. Yeah. So Frank, going back into your time period, what did colonial Americans think about the environment and their nature and their place within it?
Well, it's a good question, David. To some extent, this too is an actual follow-on from last week's episode when we talked about tobacco in Virginia and the efforts of the earliest settlers in what became the United States, but in British North America during the 17th century, to exploit the land and the landscape. I mean, they came to North America seeking to make their fortunes, and the way they did that to a large extent was by exploiting natural resources that were available there. And there was a early the belief took root very early that America or North America was a land of abundance, but also it was dangerous as well. So the natural environment in North America was seen by Europeans, again, particularly people from these islands, as a particularly hostile and dangerous place, and the environment was something to be conquered and tamed. There's a very famous sermon which was given in Massachusetts in 1670 by a Puritan minister named Samuel Danforth, which will be familiar to some of our listeners, called Errand into the Wilderness. And I went and looked at the opening to or the opening of that sermon, which was published in 1670 by Danforth, and he was decrying what he saw as the Puritans' loss, the fact that they lost their way by 1670. So we're two generations, we're into the second generation of settlement, and they've supposedly lost their way. And Danforth is reminding the Puritans of Massachusetts of why they came. And these, if you'll indulge me, I'll read you just a couple of sentences from it.
But you have to do it in the appropriate voice and intonation.
I wouldn't know what I have to read it in the Massachusetts accent.
No, that would be awful.
Weather. So, whether we have not in a great measure for, or to do it in Massachusetts, whether we have not in a great measure, sorry, forgotten our errand in the wilderness, you have solemnly professed before God, angels, men, the cause of your leaving your country, kindred, and fathers' houses, and transporting yourselves with your wives, little ones, and substance over the vast ocean into this waste and howling wilderness was your liberty to walk in the faith of the gospel. And then he goes on about their religious mission. That was the point of the sermon. But I want to just kind of pause over that language for a second. So Danforth is beginning with this sort of assertion that the Puritan settlers in New England had left their homes. They'd left a good place to go into this howling waste and wilderness on their religious mission. So the wilderness itself, as seen by Danforth, and I think this is typical of the Puritan outlook, is one of the dangers of America. It's something to be overcome. It's something to be tamed. It's not something that he's romanticizing. If anything, he's seeing it in quite a hostile light. Now, the Puritans had a particular worldview, and I'm not arguing, as historians once did, that the Puritan worldview defines America. Mm-hmm. But what we see what we saw last week with our Virginians at approximately the same time, they too saw the wilderness as something to exploit and something to be hazarded with, if you will.
For slightly different reasons.
Of course.
I was reading this morning a 1775 farming handbook called American Husbandry.
Were you?
Seriously, that's what I was doing this morning.
Lives are incredibly glamorous, people.
Before I went to climate strike, this thing. And he pointed out that tobacco farmers were a very distinct breed of people because they saw land fundamentally as disposable, that they recognized that tobacco grew best on freshly cleared land, and that therefore, they would cut down all the trees, plant tobacco, and then 2 or 3 years later, cut down some more trees and plant new tobacco and abandon the old land. And he marveled that he said this is a very distinct departure from agricultural practice in Britain, in the rest of Europe, in the, at that point, northern colonies. Where people were much more interested in taking wild things and making them settled, but then continuing to live on them and develop them once they were settled. The tobacco farmer, he said, had this unusual insatiable appetite for land, and it was connected with the way in which they sort of saw land as being infinitely available, and that the profits that could be made in the short term by sort of cutting down more trees and growing fresh tobacco with enslaved labor was really sort of at the heart of their ways in which they related to natural spaces.
That's right. I mean, that's absolutely right. And I think the key element there is this belief that there's an inexhaustible supply of land, and therefore you can just move on. And so more careful methods of husbandry don't necessarily develop everywhere in America because there's always a belief you can move on. And historians like Tim Breen and David Hackett Fisher have demonstrated how this conditioned early American development, in fact, American development down in the 19th century. And this imbues, Jefferson's articulation, Jefferson's view of the early United States as a place where the yeoman farmer, is God's chosen. He says, I don't know whether God has chosen people, but if he does, it's the tillers of the soil.
Sure.
Right? But Jefferson's vision of political economy was premised on the expansion of the United States in space and across space, in order to forestall the deleterious effects of industrialization and things like that. And so, but that vision of the country is based on the fact that there will be space.
Yeah.
And that leads to an aggressive foreign policy, and its expansion and everything else, but it also leads to an environmental or a type of husbandry, or encourages a type of husbandry that's quite exploitative,
sure,
in the way you've just described.
And part of the reason why I'm reading this book, American Husbandry, from 1775 this morning, my free time, in as much as I have free time, as I'm writing this environmental history of slavery at the moment, some listeners may know that. And one of the arguments I'm making in this book is that the people who claim ownership of other people see their wealth invested in the people that they own, and the land as being a disposable commodity, and so that, you know, they can always move their enslaved people west to new soil to cut down new trees to plow new fields, and that's one of the reasons why white Southerners are particularly expansionistic in their worldview, starting with people like Jefferson, who, you know, do things like purchase Louisiana, or James K. Polk, who goes to war with Mexico to acquire new land, because new land is sort of embedded within the entire system.
Jefferson, you're absolutely right. Well, yeah, when Jefferson makes Louisiana Purchase or oversees that, one of the things he says is, you know, this will see fulfill our land needs to a thousand generation. Which,
yeah,
of course, is not true.
Yeah.
It's going to be 46 years before before Polk comes along and the United States acquires territory all the way to the Pacific. But they believe in expansion, but they also kind of underestimate the environmental impact of what they're doing. They can't comprehend it.
Well, I think they do comprehend some of it. I mean, I think they look at, you know, and Jefferson writes about this, and Washington writes about these Virginia planters, sort of the revolutionary generation, write about the fact that, like, all of their neighbors are either switching to, you know, a different crop, or trying to do different kinds of agricultural things to make up for the fact their soil has been destroyed, or they're all moving to Alabama.
Right, that's right.
And, you know, by the end of Jefferson's life, you know, he's still up on his mountaintop, and lots of his neighbors have gone west because they see that as the profitable option.
Well, he too switches to wheat because
exactly,
for the very same reason, and success. Yeah. But
if he was smart, he would have moved to Alabama, and probably wouldn't have ended up in so much debt.
In answer to your original question, the colonists in the 17th century bring different assumptions about land, different sets of assumptions of land, so they don't necessarily agree with each other, except insofar as the land is there either to be tamed or to be conquered or exploited.
Yeah.
And this imbues the assumptions of Americans in the new United States in the late 18th, early 19th century, I think, and right down through your period. And it's not until later, and we'll get to this in a minute, you get a recognition that actually this may not work, and the land and the natural resources in the country are not limitless, and there's a movement towards conservation. Mm-hmm. Prior to that, however, and something we might want to just acknowledge, is there were, from a relatively early period, people writing about nature and what we might think of as today kind of prototype or prototypical environmental writers. Mm-hmm. And I'm thinking in this case, and you probably have more to add to the list, I'm thinking of people like William Bartram, who wrote a travel book describing what's now the southeast United States. He published it in 1791. Mm-hmm. Bartram's Travels is a kind of landmark in American nature writing. He actually made his travels in the 1770s, between 1773 and 77. A bit later, you get John James Audubon, you get Henry David Thoreau, you get a number of people tackling nature in different ways. I don't know.
There's dozens and dozens of European scientists, biologists, geologists, people who are interested in natural phenomena, a variety of different disciplines, who travel to the United States because they see Britain in particular as being so, you know, devoid of unadulterated nature, that Britain has been fully, all the trees have been cut down, and there's few spaces to go to see things, and they go to the United States partially to catalog plants and animals and things that are new to science. but also to have experienced sort of a wilderness that one couldn't find in Europe. And so as a destination for natural sciences, that, you know, the United States is the place to go in the end of the 18th and the early part of the 19th century.
Have you read Larry McMurtry's, Larry McMurtry's a prolific writer, of course, contemporary writer, but he's written a lot about the West and a lot of historical fiction.
Yeah.
The Berry Bender narratives?
I don't think I have. I've read some of his work, but
If I can interject what could be construed as a last drop. So it's a series of four books. They're very quick reads. I mean, it's not high literature, and it's not even McMurtry's best stuff, but very entertaining. And it's about this huge aristocratic English family and their hangers-on who travel up the Missouri River in the 1830s, in part because the patriarch of this clan, whose name now escapes me, but he's something Lord Berrybender, is interested in. He's one of these figures, he's a fictional character, but he's one of these figures who wants to experience the wilderness and shoot a buffalo and all these sorts of things. And it's a sort of satire, it's a satirical look at that phenomenon you're talking about, because there were dozens and dozens, as you say, of Europeans who came to America to experience what they thought would be authentic wilderness in the 1830s.
Yes.
Even as it's passing. I mean, that's really McMurtry's theme, that this, it's all a fantasy. It's passing. And they're all dying. They get killed in all manner of ways, and often quite comically. And it's, on one hand, it's a satire about sort of Europeans in America and transatlantic views of the way that, so the Americans are taken in by these people because they're aristocrats, they're British aristocrats, but the Berrybenders are idiots. it's very good, but it kind of relates to this theme you've just been talking about.
Yeah, I mean, one of the more interesting chroniclers of people who travel and to try to find both wild spaces and travel to the parts of the United States that were not its own is Frederick Law Olmsted.
Right, of course.
He's sort of a polymath. He's sort of a journalist, abolitionist, landscape architect, and 12 other things, who writes a series of books about his travels, mostly in the American South, in the 1840s and 1850s. And, you know, he's chronicling there both, like, the natural landscape. He's very aware of the ways in which the wild space in the South are different from wild spaces in the North. He's writing for a Northern audience. But also he's very cognizant of the ways in which enslaved labor is changing the landscape and the ways in which the boundary between nature and monoculture are being blurred. He, of course, then later goes on to become the main architect for Central Park.
Right. It is interesting that he's sort of, he's not only we could see him as a nature writer and a travel writer, but also he kind of contributes to our story, as it were, in another way by trying to create natural space in urban environments.
Yeah, so by the end of, you know, the 19th century, the sort of the movement to create parks in the United States, to create natural spaces is important because people see there being a, even if they're not natural, I mean, like Central Park is the most not natural place in the world in some ways because it's entirely artificially created. But it's supposed to evoke certain ideas about what a natural space was supposed to do for somebody. And cities start to really take that seriously as a need urban people have to be out in nature. I mean, and that connects back to sort of people like the transcendentalists, people like Thoreau, who are writing about the importance of nature in the context of the market revolution. But as anyone who's read Walden knows, he's both out in nature, but he's also basically in the outskirts of town, and he visits people regularly. People visit him, and his mother brings him
lunch. he's not unlike. I mean, yes, he's like somebody camping out in the back in their back garden.
Yes.
But what's interesting, David, I think, is that what you see is this transformation between the 17th century and the mid 19th century between the natural environment being something dangerous and threatening or something that has to be conquered and exploited to something that's idealized and romanticized.
And to be preserved and enjoyed and appreciated and have some kind of spiritual value in and of itself.
Right, but denuded of danger as well.
Yes, exactly. There are no bears in Walden. There were
right. Yeah. No, well, he lives in a suburb. but yes, that's right. So it's there's a change in attitude towards nature, and that change is important because it'll lay the foundation for the conservation movement of the late 19th century, and then arguably the environmental movement that starts in the 1960s that we're in the midst of to some extent. So there's an interesting transformation that goes on, and I think these nature writers like Bartram, the early ones in particular, are going to set the stage for. Well, it's not just Europeans. I mean, Lewis and Clark's expedition is a nature writing exercise. Although one of the ways they collect specimens is by shooting everything in their path. But that's the way.
What are they going to do?
Naturalists operated in the early 19th century, and there was a perception that it was limitless. Although it should be observed that one of the things I don't know whether we mentioned this yet. We don't just have the global climate strike today, but yesterday Science magazine reported that nearly one third of the wild birds in the United States and Canada have disappeared since 1970. 2.9 billion birds are missing. That's a lot of birds. So the limitlessness that was apparent to early settlers, or the apparent limitlessness, is no longer true, to be sure. So, Lewis and Clark would shoot what they saw in order to send back samples because there were lots of samples. Seemed that they were ultimately limitless.
Passenger pigeons that would darken the skies, kinds of things. Right, so exactly. If you shoot one, what's the
arm? Exactly, exactly.
You know, and thinking about when people start to become aware of this, the limits, I think it's really at the end of the 19th century when you've got a couple of things going on. One of it, of course, is the closing of the frontier, famously in the census of 1890, people start to recognize that there isn't an infinite number of bison. In fact, the bison population has collapses due to widespread hunting, often hunting where the animals would simply be left to rot or skinned, and then just left their bones to bleach in the sun. And there's a couple of different movements that happened simultaneously in the end of the 19th century, in the early part of the 20th century, and what is usually called the progressive era. I mean, one is the conservation movement, right? You want to talk a little about what the conservationists wanted to do?
Yeah, although I think there's one other text I'd like to mention before we get to that, which is a book which I took a quick look at online this morning in researching this. I can't confess to have a deep knowledge of it, but it was written by a man named George Perkins Marsh. And I'm very interested because it was published in 1864, so it's relatively early. And it's called Man and Nature, and the subtitle is Or Physical Geography as Modified by Human Action. Huh. It's one of the first books where somebody makes the case that human activity is changing the environment. It's one of the earliest. So in that sense, it's kind of a foundational text for the modern environmental movement, which is arguing that human activity is changing the environment. Yeah. And indeed, that's one of the debates over global warming and climate change isn't whether the climate is changing, but who's responsible for it. And the deniers want to say, well, this is just a natural cycle. But as early as 1864, Marsh was making this argument that human activity was changing the environment. And I think that's a text we might want to return to, but it's an important precursor and helps inform the conservation movement mentioned. But
sort of a counterpoint to that, we're thinking about when do you have an environmental movement or environmental movements starting in the United States. It's not really until the end of the 19th century. You do have environmental movements happening in Europe well before that. For instance, here in Edinburgh in 1850, there was a huge summit of, let me see, I've got the official title, of British Association for conservation here in Edinburgh. They were very concerned, in fact, that there weren't an adequate number of trees left in Britain.
Right.
And that humans had cut down all the trees, which they had. And I think there's similar movements that are going on in France and Germany and other places where, in some ways, they had reached that limit or knowledge about the limit that much earlier.
Or believed they'd reached the limit because these are, those were environments that had long been settled and seemingly occupied. Now, of course, North America had been occupied for tens of thousands of years. In a very different way. And so the conservation movement, back to your question of a couple of minutes ago, the conservation movement in the United States might lag behind that in Europe because the perception that the land was filled, and I'm using air quotes now again, doesn't really take root until the late 19th century when it seems that the land is full. It's not actually full. It's not full to this day, but this does lead...
In as much as one can define what full is.
Well, yeah, of course. But this leads to, kind of energizes the American conservation movement, which is seeking to conserve the wilderness or an imagined wilderness. And so, you know, the Scots immigrant John Muir is a part of this movement, a real strong advocate for it. Theodore Roosevelt is, as the president. I mean, so the National Park System is created then.
Well, yeah, but there's a tension though within. I mean, the thinking about what's going on during the Progressive Era, there's I think really sort of two competing movements going on, right? So you've got people like Teddy Roosevelt, Gifford Pinchot, who was the head of the Forest Service, who saw resources, water, trees, minerals being wasted, and wanted to figure out a way to sort of rationalize their usage, you know, and so. They were concerned, you know, Roosevelt was concerned people were hunting in an irresponsible way, so we should place limits on things. But it was still fundamentally about usage and about having nature being available for people to exploit just in a rational way. Muir, on the other hand, I think had a very different take about the ways in which people should relate to nature. He said, I think he thought nature was good on its own terms, and that nature should, if we can, preserve those parts of nature without, you know, for its own benefit and for the benefit of the planet rather than using nature necessarily for exploitation. And, you know, Roosevelt and Muir got along sometimes. You know, Muir famously took him around Yosemite. But they also got into fights a bunch of times. And probably the sort of classical example of that is the plan to build a dam in the Hetch Hetchy Valley, where they needed to build a dam to provide water for San Francisco, which desperately needed water. And Muir and the Sierra Club said, like, no, if we build this dam, we're destroying this huge natural beauty that will be underwater if we build a dam here. And there's a sort of tension between the Roosevelt administration, who once said, look, we need this water for this growing city to prosper, and if we have to manipulate the environment to do so, we have to manipulate the environment to do so. And so there's I think from the very beginning within the environmental movements in the United States, there's this tension between those people who see nature as something that should be preserved for human usage, but still used, and those people who want to preserve things because there's something inherently good about nature and wilderness. I think Muir is really much more in that sort of latter camp.
Whereas Roosevelt sort of represents, or that debate is an interesting one. I'm glad you mentioned that because it represents the kind of tension between the environmentalists, the perceived tension between the environmental movement, people who want to preserve the environment, and those people who believe in development and progress and growth.
Yeah.
And this is a perennial, whether it was the debate over the spotted owl back in the 1980s and logging rights and so
this, to ANWR and in Alaska.
Right. This has really long, deep roots in America. And I think that I'm glad you made that distinction because I think the tension or the between Muir and what Muir stood for and Roosevelt's vision. Roosevelt wants to preserve and conserve natural spaces, but he also wants progress.
One of the things Roosevelt started before, you know, he held elected office and all those kinds of things was the Boone and Crockett Club, where he wanted to sort of set up, you know, a club of people like him who enjoyed natural spaces, but enjoyed natural spaces to go and hunt things. Shoot stuff and go fishing and build cabins in the woods and, you know, use wilderness. And try to preserve, you know, some degree of nature, but do so in a managed way. I mean, that divide, I think, is sort of inscribed in the ways in which federal land use policy is working right now. So you've got, you know, people think of large amounts of land in the United States is owned by the federal government. Some of it is natural parks, which are intended to be preserving wild spaces as much as they can, although most national parks are,
more recreational
spaces. Well, they're recreational spaces, but, in parts of them, which ones you go to and how visited they are. With things like the National Forest Service, where there is huge amounts of land that is used, that's owned by the federal government, that is used by logging companies or used by mining companies or used by, cattle ranchers and whatnot, that is supposed to be both natural land but also used land, and the question is about how to use it in a responsible way.
So it's about managing a resource.
For people's economic benefit and what have you.
What's interesting is it seems that in terms of the administrative history of these various bureaucracies and these entities within the United States government, the U.S. government taking responsibility for managing the environment, let's say, there are two real phases. There's the progressive era when you get the creation of institutions like the National Forest Service and so on, and then we see in the 1970s, in the aftermath of the if you will, the new environmental movement, the creation, the adoption of legislation and more robust, you get the Environmental Protection Agency, you get the Clean Water Act in 1970, things like this. That are so there are kind of two phases. We seem, unfortunately, it seems to me to be in a phase, at least in terms of government action, of kind of deregulation. So President Trump was just removing some of the Clean Water Act's restrictions last week, and so which seems at odds with what we're seeing in the streets literally today. I mean, we can't quite see them outside our window, but they're not far from where we're sitting right now. All those protesters. So there's a kind of
The closest parallel, I think, to what's happening today might be the first Earth Day in 1970. So the background to this is that the environment in the 1960s was pretty awful, and there's sort of two events that sort of immediately precede the first Earth Day that really led to its creation. The first is the burning of the Cuyahoga River in Cleveland, where the river in Cleveland caught on fire, right, because of the industrial pollution that had flowed into the river. And the second was a oil spill in Santa Barbara in 1969, in which millions of gallons of oil, it's like the third biggest oil spill in American history, after the Deep Horizon and the Exxon Valdez. But at that point, it was the biggest oil spill, and of course, it's right off the California coast.
A very nice part of the California coast, to be sure, where people own very expensive property.
Well, that and where it killed a lot of birds.
Right. The other thing I'd say, sorry, before you carry on, just by way of it, laying the groundwork for this, I also think the publication of Silent Spring by Rachel Carson in 1962
is vitally important. Right? So there's a bunch of other things that are going on. There's a growing environmental awareness that precedes the first Earth Day, but I think the person who usually gets credit for it is Gaylord Nelson, the congressman from Wisconsin. But in reality, I think what happened at the first Earth Day, much of the organizing of the event in April of 1970 was done at the local level. A lot of it was done on university campuses. A lot of it was done in schools. A lot of it was done by local community groups. Much in the same way that the climate protests today, I mean, there's ostensibly some sort of international organizations, people setting things up. But 90% of the organizing, almost all of the organizing is happening at local levels. That's being, they picked a date and a time, but beyond that, it's all being done quite locally. So I think there's, that similarity is quite prevalent. The role of young people in both cases, I think, is also very important. I mean, many of you know this, but the climate protests today, began with climate protests in schools that were started by high school age children. Do you want to talk about Greta briefly? I mean,
the kind of face of that is Greta Thunberg, the Swedish activist who recently crossed the Atlantic in a carbon neutral vessel. Yes,
exactly.
She sailed across the Atlantic.
She's amazing.
She is amazing to go speak. She spoke in a Congress earlier this week, and she met President Obama.
She
and
spoke
so
at the United Nations.
Yeah, spoke at the United Nations. So she's has become kind of the face of this. Interestingly, She's also the target of the backlash against it, which is kind of curious. Yeah. Well, it's not curious. And so people opposed to doing anything about the environment or accepting climate change as reality have attacked her personally, especially on the right.
I hate those people.
Well, yeah.
She's amazing. I'm sorry.
I understand that. I mean, the one thing I would say is, and I've heard people say you shouldn't criticize her because she's a child, and that's a fair point, except she's a public figure and made herself a public figure. So you can't be a public figure and not be open to criticism.
To be sure.
But I agree with you. I'm very sympathetic to her. I'm not saying attack a child, and nor am I saying attack that child. But she's quite an amazing figure. Interestingly, on the fringes of the protest here in Edinburgh today, when I was wandering around there, I saw two people who appeared to be Edinburgh University students, one with a sign that was supporting the protest, and another who was clearly critical, who was criticizing her. And I overheard a snippet of conversation where this young man was very critical of her and really personalizing his opposition to the climate strike based on his criticism of her as being self-aggrandizing and an egomaniac and all sorts of things, which didn't seem appropriate to me. But in answer to in response to what you said, she's emerged as the face of this. She's a Swedish activist who's emerged as kind of face of this youth movement, but she herself says this really isn't about me. This is about all of us.
But I guess getting back to the bigger point I was making is that that this is a movement that has been largely led by and orchestrated by young kids, people, high school students. They've been marching here in Edinburgh every Friday for months, and it's all been organized by high school students. Similar marches around the world.
Message is quite simple, which is basically, you're not doing enough about this, adults, but we're going to have to live with this
for decades, after
you're gone. And, so Thunberg said to Congress the other day, you're doing something, but you're not doing enough. Yeah. And I saw an essay in The New Yorker earlier today that said something, the words to the effect, the quote was, sorry, I can't remember who the author was, which was unfortunate. There's never been a greater disparity between what the science is telling us and the political will to do something about it.
Yeah.
And I think that it's that disparity that these young people and these young activists have really kind of found their space.
Yeah. So thinking back to the first Earth Day in 1970, one of the commonalities there is the role that young people played in both the events today and in the first Earth Day, in terms of the energy of that moment was created by young people, and then they're much drawing upon the role of youth activism and things like the civil rights movement, where young people played a critical role, and in the anti-war movement and other places in which young people were vocal and active. The consequences, though, of the first Earth Day, I think, were quite profound, as you mentioned earlier. There's an immediate political reaction, part of it in response to Earth Day, part of it in response to these other things that are going on, to really have a government response to this environmental crisis, whether that's the creation of the EPA, Clean Air Act, Clean Water Act, Endangered Species Act, a number of other regulations to scale back the level of pollution and to create a sort of system for environmental regulation. And this, of course, is done by the Nixon administration. And the Nixon administration is not who you first think of as being deeply invested in the environment. Nixon himself doesn't seem to have been a particularly environmentally friendly guy himself in his personal life. I heard he liked to have fires in the White House in the summer, just because he liked to have fires and then cranked up the air conditioning so that the fire wasn't too hot. But, it was that administration that really created this framework, which... unfortunately seems to be partially dismantled at the moment under the current administration. What's happened with the American environmental movement since 1970? I think that's an important part of the story. How do we get from 1970 and the first Earth Day and then the aftermath of that with the EPA and the Clean Air Act, Clean Water? How do you get from there to today?
Well, that's a good question. I think there's a moment in the 70s where people think, we've kind of solved that problem.
Yeah.
But then a number of more serious, well, sorry, more obviously serious problems manifested themselves. Mm-hmm. So you may be too young to remember the panic over the ozone layer. Do you remember that?
I remember the panic over the ozone layer. You know, so with the hairspray and
right,
the one
eye. Right, and deodorant and all that. So there's a great concern about the hole in the ozone layer in the late 70s and early 80s. And then there was a concern. And these are, sorry, I don't mean to suggest these weren't serious problems or not continuing problems. They were. There was the concern about acid rain in the early 80s and its impact on forests. Mm. And then the accident of Three Mile Island in the nuclear plant there. Sure. in Pennsylvania. And these things combined, I think, to create a sense of environmental crisis. And I think there have been people since the late 60s who have been very concerned about the environment. There's no question about that. And the other thing that I think is really important, I think that environmental questions became central both to scientific inquiry. So a lot of the science that concerns global warming and climate change, a better way to frame it is climate change, really began to be undertaken at that period because there was institutional support in terms of both from governments and crucially from universities, where this became central to a lot of university research and ecology, as it was called, was something that, you know, entered the university curriculum. Mm. And so I think that the landscape changed somewhat, and awareness, you know, recycling became a thing. You know? But by the same token, it also became contested. I think in the 1960s, there wasn't anybody making the other case. There was nobody, when the Cuyahoga River was on fire, nobody said, well, that's all right. Yeah. Who cares? But I think the Koch brothers, for example, in the United States invested heavily in contesting this, and the fossil fuel industry invested heavily in trying to counter the science and create us, you know, in the name of balance, tried to put the other case. And you know, that began with... it really ramped up in the 1990s with the Second Earth Day, which you might want to say something about, and the climate summit in Rio in 1992, but also it coincided with the birth of Fox News in the early 90s.
To be sure.
And so those things meant... So on one hand, I think that the knowledge became a little more widespread and a bit more sophisticated, and the sense of urgency in response to specific crises like the ozone layer, or the hole in the ozone, or the or acid rain... ramped up, but at the same time there was this kind of counter narrative, and this flood of counter information became available that greatly complicated things. Yeah. So, all the while the earth was warming.
Well, one thing that was happening, I think, in the aftermath of the early 1970s and the legislation put in place then, is those laws worked.
Yes. Right? Yes.
Like the water is cleaner most places.
And the air is cleaner
most places. Right? If you look at pictures of New York City in the 1970s, it's a smoggy haze of, not, you know, you can't see anything, right? And part of that's bad film technology, but also it's like the air is cleaner.
No, and emissions restrictions.
Exactly, right. California, worked. Like Los Angeles, you can see things in Los Angeles now because California put in very strict emissions requirements on its cars, and the amount of smog decreased. So, I mean, I think these laws worked, right? Like the California condor got saved, and so there's ways in which, many people I think got lulled into this belief that oh well, you know, we've actually fixed some of these problems, and the problems that were addressed by those laws were ones that were very visible, right? When the river's on fire, you can see the river being on fire. When the air is so thick, you can, you know, like it's like soup, you know, then that's a problem you can see. I think the climate problem is, on the one hand, a much bigger problem because it's a global problem, requires a global response, but it manifests itself in a very different way than the river being on fire.
That's right. And it's so vast, and on one hand it's very immediate. We've had, you know, I don't know, 19 of the 20 warmest years on record have been in this century, for example. So we can see it around us. We can experience it every summer, or we can experience it in the wintertime with extremes of weather, all that kind of thing. But by the same token, the problem is so vast and so abstract.
Yeah.
At some level, appreciating parts per million of CO2 in the atmosphere is something that's difficult to get your head around. And there's a sense, I think, in contrast to the 1970 Earth Day, there's a sense of urgency now, but there's also a sense of hopelessness.
Yeah.
That, because we keep hearing nothing we do can really change it. Have we passed the tipping point? We don't keep hearing that, but that's one of the things one hears.
Mm.
And that has led, it's given urgency to those kids who are out in the streets today, but it's also, I think, given a sense of kind of hopelessness about it. So it's a very defeat. I don't remember Earth Day in 1970, but it's a very different moment,
right.
Cultural moment.
Yeah, so Earth Day got revived in 1990 in the 20th anniversary of it, and we've had a sort of Earth Day celebrated every year since then. In my mind, the modern incarnation of Earth Day, which has become a global phenomenon, not just an American one, has taken on a very different tone, especially in recent years, than the original Earth Day did. I think the original Earth Day had this belief that these problems could be fixed, and I think increasingly there's this fear that some of these problems are so huge and the inability of governments to respond to them in a meaningful way. I think part of what's happening today is sort of a response to that, that there's a frustration and anger about the inability of governments to do anything. Not long after Earth Day got revived in 1990, there was this UN summit in Rio to sort of deal with global environmental problems, and it's happening right at the end of the Cold War, and so the world is reconsidering how it prioritizes these global organizations and communities, and George Herbert Walker Bush goes there and he says, "Hi, I'm the environmental president." And all the other delegates looked at him and they said, "Well, that's nice. I'm the Easter Bunny, right? Because you're clearly not, you may say things about being environmentally progressive. The modern Earth Day has become corporatized in all kinds of ways. But it's often not with the same kind of commensurate action that's needed to combat climate change, which is a problem unlike one the human race has ever faced before, and does require really phenomenal action that is not happening, at least not in the U.S. and definitely not in the U.K. at the moment.
Yes. Yeah. I don't know what to say to that, but to agree. Now, there are, it's hard not to be inspired by the millions of people. I mean, if you're on Twitter right now who are in the streets protesting about this, and if they take action, I mean, I hope there are people registering them to vote in the various polities where they live. That would be helpful. And there are actions we can all take. And I say this with a huge amount of guilt. I fly a lot, and flying is one of the worst things you can do for the environment. I fly on business a lot for the university, and the university is committed to being carbon neutral, I think by 20, I don't know the end date, it might be 2040, something like that, but it's probably sooner than that. But how we achieve that, these are, and everybody thinks their own trip is important, and to be sure there are important trips, but there are things we can do. Cutting back on flying would be one. Cutting out red meat would be another. Mm. That's one I can do much more easily than flying, and I'm kind of committed to doing that, I think, because it turns out red meat is terrible for the environment. The production of red meat is terrible. It's not good for you anyway. It's vaping for adults. and it's important to take these steps, but governmental action is going to be required as well. Yeah. And there was hope after the Paris Climate Accord, and President Trump has set that back, I think, at least as far as the United States is concerned. But, there's an election next year. We can't give up. I don't know what else to say.
The disjuncture between, I think, what we know about the status of the planet at the moment, the very precarious place that we're in, and I'm saying this in the context of, there's flooding right now in Houston, which may be connected to climate change. We're in the middle of hurricane season, which has been a rough one already. But the disjunction between the precarious place we're in and the silence of global governments, but especially at the moment the U.S. government, is astounding. Now, obviously, the British government right now is so subsumed with Brexit and its implications that their long term thinking is.
Well, that illustrates one of the problems, actually, because this is a long term problem. And democracies are very ill-suited for long-term problems because they either are distracted by the immediate, or the voters are distracted by, or they don't believe the voters will. You're asking people to vote for a better world 80 years from now,
and to make sacrifices now, and people don't like making sacrifices.
No, especially sacrifices that might affect their quality of life.
Yeah,
whether it's economic growth or whether it's simply, you know, you want air conditioning because it's so hot in Texas.
To be sure.
You know, and that's a difficult ask in a democracy. I mean, there's a kind of paradox here that authoritarian states might be better equipped to deal with climate change because, you know, a state like China can impose restrictions in a way that a democracy cannot do so. But China shows no interest in doing so.
To be sure.
It's a very interesting moment, or this problem presents some unique challenges. Mm-hmm. But reiterate, we can vote according to the environment and make that a priority, and we can change the way we live our daily lives. I think those are the two things that people can do.
So everyone out there, demand that your politicians take this seriously, because there's lots of serious things in the world right now that need addressing, but this is probably the most important.
It would seem so.
All right. So let's what's your last drop, Frank? Let's go.
Well, my last drop.
Give something to give us some hope.
Do have a happy last drop. I want to endorse a CD. Oh, not even a CD. A new set of recordings.
Sound like Joe Biden with a record player.
I do. But this really is an album and it's coherent. I'm going to endorse a record if I'm Joe
Phonograph.
Biden.
A phonograph.
Right. For the old Victrola this weekend.
Wax cylinder.
I want to endorse an album, I'm going to use that word, by The High Women. And The High Women, I do you like country music?
I like some country music.
I like country music. And country music is politically challenging in many regards.
Sure.
The High Women are a super group consisting of Brandi Carlile, Natalie Hemby, Maren Morris, and Amanda Shires.
Okay.
And they're a direct, they are paying homage and or subverting, of course, the Highwaymen, who were a supergroup in the 1980s, consisting of Willie Nelson, still alive and recording, Johnny Cash, Waylon Jennings, and Kris Kristofferson. And if you remember the original Highwaymen, they were kind of a supergroup of all men. Their signature song that gave them their name was a song called High Women by written by Jimmy Webb. And the High Women have recorded an album of what can best be described as feminist country songs,
okay,
including a reworking of the original Jimmy Webb song, High Women,
okay,
called High Women. And that goes through history. It begins with, it actually begins with the account of a Honduran migrant crossing the Rio Grande, but goes back to the Salem witch trials. You got to listen to it. You got to listen to that. Both the title track, but the whole album is great.
It's
really, really good. And I can't recommend The High Women enough. It dropped on September 6th. It's available on Spotify
and
other places you can stream music, or even if you buy CDs or even vinyl. So I am endorsing The High Women. It does bring to mind, I haven't seen it because this is just premiered in the United States, Ken Burns' new History of Country Music, which is out, and I've seen some of the reviews of it, which are generally laudatory. Ken Burns always gets positive reviews. We might take a different view. It's very good to realize that not all country music is necessarily schlocky or necessarily kind of endorsing right-wing politics. There's a left-wing country tradition as well. Anyway, listen to The High Women. Everybody, listen to The High Women this weekend. You won't regret it.
All right.
What about you, David?
I have a little announcement that listeners to this podcast will be the first people to know. It's actually not officially announced yet, but you know, I'm in charge of this thing, so I can announce it. And that is the date and location of SASA 2020.
SASA. Yes!
Frank's excited. Right, this is good. So SASA is the Scottish Association for the Study of America. It's an organization that is really one of the centers for study of American history and literature and culture and studies and all kinds of things here in Scotland. And we're having our 2020 conference in Dundee on February 29th, Leap Day. So
Dundee is the city of discovery.
City, and they've got a new museum. Their new V&A museum is really extraordinary, and a fun place to go. So that's where it's going to be on February 29th. But more details to come shortly.
Excellent. Great. Okay. Cheers. Well, David, cheers.
The Whiskey Rebellion is hosted by David Silkenet and Frank Cogliano. David is a senior lecturer in American history at the University of Edinburgh, and Frank is Professor of American History and Dean International for North America at the University of Edinburgh. The Whiskey Rebellion is available on iTunes, Stitcher, and Podbean. You can follow the show on Twitter at WhiskeyRebelPod and like the show on Facebook for updates about current and future episodes.